Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 176 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm thrilled to introduce my co-hosts. First up is our pilot and GA guy, Rob Mark.
Hey, it is me, actually, and it's I just got back from Paris. I just returned from Paris the other night, and I'm now glad to be part of this show with you all.
Did you pick up anything other than that accent?
Accent? No. In fact, they were making funny jokes over there in Paris about Inspector Clouseau, but I was over there actually to be part of a conference on an aviation safety conference about how pilots cope with the unknown. So maybe we can talk about that later.
Absolutely.
Anyway, good evening to everybody.
Also with us is our airline dork, Dan Webb.
That took you a little while, but hey, Max, David, and assorted others. It's always good to be with you.
And also with us, of course, is our aviation historian and military aviation guy, David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
Hey, folks. How are you? Thanks for listening early.
Our guest this episode is Greg Morris. He's the chief pilot at Gauntlet Warbirds, which is a warbird, aerobatic, and tailwheel training center. They're headquartered at Aurora Airport, just west of downtown Chicago. Now, Greg's been flying for, I guess, about 15 years. He's been instructing in warbirds and aerobatic aircraft for the past 10. He also holds a current low-level aerobatic waiver in the L-39 and T-6, and he's a fast-rated formation pilot. Welcome to the podcast, Greg.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
They used to say I was fast, too, but I don't think it had anything to do with airplanes. But that was a long time ago.
Yeah, they don't say that anymore.
No.
Now, Greg, you both train and offer rides in some pretty interesting aircraft.
That's correct, yeah. Gauntlet, we've got, for aircraft we've got available for rides, that includes our T-6, our Extra 300, and the Stearman we're bringing online in the spring. We offer training in every aircraft in the fleet. The fleet includes two Decathlons, two T-6s, an Extra 300, the L-39, a Yak 52, and a Stearman. We'd love to be able to sell rides in the L-39 and the Yak, but unfortunately, FAA regulations don't allow it. It's both certified in the experimental exhibition category. You can offer training if you got a private ticket, but if you don't, unfortunately, we can't touch you, which is really disappointing.
Fantastic. Well, we're looking forward to talking to you about flying warbirds and other cool airplanes. Before we do that, though, we're going to talk a bit about the aviation news from the past week. And then David is going to regale us with his knowledge of aviation history in his This Week in Aviation segment. And of course,
no pressure there, folks.
That's right. Yeah, but you always come through, David. We've also got this week's Australia Desk and Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment. And we've got some more Grill the Geeks questions coming up. And we'll finish up with some of the listener mail that we received in the past week or so. So first, let's get started with some aviation news. Everybody ready?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Our first story comes from the New York Times. American Airlines parent files for bankruptcy. Well, due to high labor costs and a heavy debt burden, the parent company of American Airlines, which of course is AMR Corporation, they filed for protection under Chapter 11 of the U.S. bankruptcy law. Now, American says they'll operate as always, and the frequent flyer program is safe, but there's probably a lot of other changes coming down the road. Now, did this bankruptcy catch anybody by surprise?
I don't think the fact that American went Chapter 11 shocked anyone. There's been a lot of speculation about this for a while now. I think what I found there's been a lot of speculation about it happening. I think I was surprised for a couple of reasons. Number one, their management, especially now former CEO Gerard Arpey, was publicly very against the idea of bankruptcy. And there are a couple interesting. There was a very interesting New York Times article about that this week. But also the fact that they did it was a little bit surprising. that they did decide to go ahead and do it. But I was more surprised in the sense that they did it at this time, and I think the timing was the most surprising.
Now, we should probably mention that U.S. bankruptcy laws are different than the bankruptcy laws in some other countries. We have kind of two chapters in the law that are relevant here. In other countries, declaring bankruptcy means you liquidate. That's it. It's over.
And that is akin to Chapter 7.
That's here. Chapter 7, right. What we have in addition to that is a Chapter 11, so-called Chapter 11, which not everybody has, which I guess, Dan, is sort of based around the concept that the company may be in trouble and debtors are going to lose out, but it's in everyone's best interests to allow them to restructure and come back without liquidating. And that's kind of what Chapter 11 is all about.
Yeah, that's right. So the company will basically declare bankruptcy, and now this goes through the courts. American at some point needs to file a plan of reorganization, and that has to be approved and such. And American has to go down with creditors and such and start negotiating deals. We could see some kinds of actually American already filed this week to reject leases on some aircraft. Granted, those leases really won't affect schedules or capacity. It's 24 aircraft. American actually has all those are four Fokker 100s that American is still paying leases on, and that's an aircraft type they retired years ago. And the other 20 are MD-80s, and I think most, if not all, of the airframes are sitting in storage. And I think a couple of the engines, at least according to the court filing, where the location was listed as TBD, where the location for everything else was Roswell, I think for everything else. So things like that, there's filings about some real estate that they don't use anymore. So it could be a way for Americans to shed some excess costs and hopefully come out stronger. Though, of course, the biggest issue here, I think, is Americans' labor situation. And Americans been very public for a while about how they have a labor cost disadvantage. And part of that's because its main competitors, U.S. Airways, Delta, and United, they've all gone through the Chapter 11 process. And granted, the employees of American definitely did sacrifice years ago in 2003, giving up concessions that at the time were slated to provide about a few hundred million in annual benefits, but Americans still at a cost disadvantage to its competitors. Well, we'll definitely see some new labor agreements emerge here, and the question is what happens. I mean, Americans kind of rare here that they've held on to their pensions, which is good for employees but expensive. I think their pension obligations for this year or next will be over $500 million. So that's a lot of cash. And the other issue here is, I mean, Americans been in negotiations with its pilots for a while, with pilots and other labor groups for a while. I think with the pilots, they've been negotiating for roughly 5 years at this point. And there was, a lot of speculation over the past month or so that it looked like management and the Americans Pilots Union, the Allied Pilots Association, were making progress, and it just seemed to stall at the end. I mean, American had a really very interesting pilot proposal a few weeks ago that the APA decided to not send to its membership. So, and I think that labor issue, I don't think it's the only issue at American. I think they have some issues on the revenue side as well, and they haven't been able to exact as much increased revenue as their competitors have over the past couple of years. I still think labor is a big issue, and I think maybe the fact that they weren't making that progress could have been the tipping point here, but that's just speculation on my part.
Rob, do you think there's anyone to blame here, or is this just something
besides Dan?
Dan.
No, that's right. We can't blame Dan for this. Oh, I think there's plenty of blame to go around. I don't think it's limited. Dan and I were talking off the air about this, and I certainly don't want to make it look like the employees are blameless in this, because There's certainly not. I mean, this comes from years and years of everybody poking at everybody else, but there just wasn't the motivation prior to this point, I don't think, to actually try to do the deal. And of course, you know, Americans been struggling since 9/11. I mean, and it's just never actually gone anywhere. And I do believe, though, that RB did want to try to do it without bankruptcy, but maybe that was never realistic. I guess my question, maybe Dan, you have a perspective on this. How long ago do you think they actually started talking about bankruptcy seriously? My guess is that this didn't just happen in the last 3 weeks.
You know, I'm sure it's an option that's always been discussed down in Dallas. Just because I think publicly there's been a lot of speculation about it. But this is just my sense, of course. I don't know, because, you know, it would be great to be a fly in the wall in the American Airlines boardroom. But I think it really only got serious probably recently over the past month or so. But that's just my guess. But, you know, we'll have to see what happens. I think it'll be interesting to see how this works on the labor side, just to get back to that, because I think it's, Rob, you know more of this than I do, but I think it's highly doubtful that the pilots at American would be getting as good a deal as they were offered a few weeks ago in bankruptcy. So,
I'm sure you're right. I think none of the employees will be.
Yeah.
And there were already employees that had signed contracts. And those are now going to go into the tank as well.
And I think the, you know, I'm very fascinated on what happens with the American pilot contract, especially on the regional side. And I know I talk about scope clauses a lot lately, just because I've just been interested in the regional industry. But American has a very restrictive scope clause. They're limited to they have just less than 50 CRJ-700s on the regional jet side. They have some ATRs as well, and they really can't grow that fleet. American had a fascinating piece of their proposal a few weeks ago, which would say that basically all regional aircraft over 50 seats, those would be flown by mainline American Airlines pilots. And that is a very dramatic change from what we've been seeing over the past few years, which was through this Chapter 11 process, we've seen more and more flying outsourced to regional carriers. American said, we bring that flying in-house, but these smaller aircraft would have special pay rates and work rules. It'd be interesting to see if that concept keeps going through this whole bankruptcy process, because if it does, it's a very interesting development that has very dramatic impacts on the regional industry.
Which, you know, one thing, and I know we've got to move on to other stories, but I think another concept that's really interesting here is that this massive order that American put down for, what do they order, 6 million airplanes or something? Or I mean, it seems like that, but you know, the largest order in airline history. But it's amazing how that just happened just a couple of weeks ago. And I'm sure that can't be a coincidence. So it's going to be interesting to see how the leases that they're able to get out of as time goes on just kind of fit in with order deliveries.
Well, it's no secret. It was no secret when that order was made that American was in a weaker financial position. And I think that what goes along with that is a very big part of that deal was the financing included in that deal. And I am sure that deal will come through here relatively unscathed. I would assume that American probably has pretty decent terms in the financing here. And but even financing aside, I mean, that order is American's future. I mean, they have an older fleet.
Yeah, you're right.
They need these, you know, they need over the future to replace these older MD-80s and 757s and so forth with these the newer 737-800s, the A320 family, which American has said will be composed of A319s and A321s. And then in the future, when they have a very large order for the 737 MAX and the A320neo. So, I mean, that order is critical to American's future. And while labor is certainly an important cost, the other very key cost for airlines is fuel, and you need to invest in your fleet to provide that natural hedge against fuel costs.
Yeah, good point.
All right, well, this will be, as Dan might say, very interesting to follow in the coming weeks and months. This process will take some time. This is not something probably that's going to transpire over the course of a few weeks. So
no, this is going to drag on for months and months. I mean, if and actually, if anyone wants to follow the whole process, there is a fascinating website, amrcaseinfo.com. And granted, it's only been a few days since American declared bankruptcy here, and there's already like 118 things filed on the docket. So it's a very this is a very complex, long process, but it will be very interesting to watch.
Okay, let's move on and talk a little bit about Boeing. We see in the Seattle Times, union members scrutinize wording of historic Boeing contract. So the big news at Boeing recently is that they say they'll build a 737 MAX in Renton, Washington only. And the company and the union have reached a four-year labor agreement. In this article, we see, quote, that the agreement includes guaranteed annual wage increases of 2% and a new bonus plan that could tack on as much as 4% more. But non-financial provisions drew the most headlines. Boeing's commitment on the 737 MAX and the union's pledge to seek an end to the National Labor Relations Board complaint against Boeing. However, the article says that some union folks think that the contract language gives Boeing an out on the 737 MAX. The contract says that Boeing will build a 737, quote, in Renton to the extent such production can be feasibly completed in the current and existing 737 Renton production facilities. So union members say, well, the current Renton plant is kind of small, and they're wondering just what Boeing has in mind here. So in any event, this is a major accomplishment. I think this is the first time in a long time that Boeing and the union have avoided a strike, usually protracted at contract time. So that's good news.
I bet Boeing is happy about that, too. I mean, they've got this nice little plant down there in South Carolina that's not getting a whole lot of use. And no, seriously, though, I mean, I think this really does say something good about both sides, that they were able to come to an agreement. And obviously, there's that National Labor Relations Board issue that was hanging over Boeing's head, too, about whether they had the right to decide to move their plants wherever they wanted or not. And it seems like there's a meeting of the minds here somewhere.
Right. I guess the charge in that case was that Boeing moved to a non-union location to sort of punish the union for its past strikes and so forth. At least that's the allegation. So that would probably get kind of ugly as that moved forward. So if that's swept aside for now anyway, that's good news. So the vote is this coming Wednesday, December 7th. So by the time a lot of people hear this, that vote will have been accomplished. And I guess hopefully there'll be an acceptance of the contract and Boeing will get to move forward. All right, let's talk now about JetBlue. So next story we see is from Flight Global. JetBlue joins WestJet in seizing LaGuardia slots, gains more at National. Now, last week in our Bits and Pieces episode, Dan speculated on the results of the recent FAA slot auction. So, Dan, how close did you come?
Well, there was just one report out the week before that JetBlue was the winner, and we've just now seen the official word from the company and the government that they were indeed the winner. So I just wanted to kind of update everyone that's exactly what happened. The other interesting thing here is the FAA revealed the identity of all the other bidders. And I think the big loser here was Southwest. So, for example, at National, JetBlue bid roughly $40 million for the slots there, and Southwest was right there behind them with $32 million. And similarly, at LaGuardia, for one of the slot bundles, JetBlue bid $32 million, WestJet bid a little bit over $17.6 million, and Southwest was there with about $13 million as a bid. So Southwest definitely was interested here, was one of the big bidders in the slot swap, but they lost out. It will be fun to watch what happens next. Being granted, Southwest was already at LaGuardia, and now they have some slots to play with. at some more slots to play with at LaGuardia, and now we'll have a presence at National through the acquisition of AirTran. But these slots would have certainly been useful for them as Southwest has put more of an emphasis on business travel, and they're still looking for opportunities to grow domestically. I'm also wondering what JetBlue will do with the slots, though I talked about that last week. And I've also been interested in looking at some of the other bidders. Frontier was another bidder at Washington National, granted a lower bidder with only about $1.75 million. But that would have been really fun to see, just because Frontier, they have service to Milwaukee, Kansas City, Omaha, and Denver from National already. But this January, they're starting service to Grand Rapids and Madison. So if they had got these eight slot pairs, would they have built up some existing flying, or would they have found some other smaller cities? Oh, well, not necessarily smaller cities, but just found more cities, period, to add. That would have been fun to watch. So an interesting thing to speculate on.
All right. Very good. Let's talk military. We have an article from airshowbuzz.com. This is U.S. Air Force Air Combat Command reduces demo teams to F-22 and T-Birds. Now, there's a quote in the article from the Air Force. It says, we face significant fiscal constraints and are making tough decisions about the best ways to continue providing combat air power to warfighting commanders, which is what we do as the Air Force's primary force provider. So, because of cost considerations, we're going to see fewer Air Force demos at air shows and things?
Because of our Congress can't get off their ass. I know you'll have to edit that out.
No, it's staying in.
we're not able to figure out a way to cut budgets. $300 billion has got to come out of the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marines over the next 3 years. Well, one of the ways to do this is, unfortunately, is they're cutting the demo teams. Now, our friend David Centauri over in Italy said it was because the Raptor can't do anything but fly demos. But the real serious consideration is the fact that the F-22 team, besides the Thunderbirds, which that would have been a very drastic cut, they are the number one recruiting tool for the United States Air Force. Hmm. The F-22 does not have a team per se. They have a staff, and they go borrow whatever F-22 is closest to the air show they're demoing.
Oh, really? They don't have dedicated airplanes?
They do not have a dedicated airframe.
Is that typical of...
They are the only ones who play that game. The other demo teams, the Strike Eagle team, the two A-10 teams, and the two F-16 teams have designated airframes that go to each air show. Hmm. So... the F-16s have Viper West and Viper East. Each one of those teams is assigned two airframes. Actually, three if you really count it. So they have two and a spare. Likewise, the two A-10 demo teams have three aircraft assigned to it. The F-15E Strike Eagle out of Seymour Johnson has three aircraft assigned to it. So for every weekend you have an air show, you're sending off three of those aircraft that could be used primarily for training. None of the squadrons that do the demos, tend to be the training squadrons. I mean, that's one of the reasons why they have spare aircraft to do the demos. So what we have now is most people who were like me growing up and got to see things like F-15s and wanted to go or F-14s wanting to go fly in the Air Force, air shows aren't going to have that recruiting tool. It's another one of the ways to cut off your nose to spite your face. You're going to lose a major recruiting tool because a lot of times these demo teams go to shows that don't have the Thunderbirds or the Blue Angels, and their high performance jet aircraft is Viper West or Viper East, you know, and at least they get to, our general public get to see the capabilities of our warfighters. This breaks my heart because I've interviewed a lot of those guys that do that, and their heart is in it, and they're all out to show the public what a positive face for the United States military. I mean, it's a good thing. but we have to find a way to cut corners. And the first thing to go is the, quote, niceties. So we're losing our... What'll be interesting to follow up on in using the Dan parlance would be, it'll be interesting to see how the Navy handles this. Because the Navy has the two F-18F Hornet demo teams, one based at Lemoore, one based at Oceana, out of the training squadrons. They also have, the Marine Corps also have a Harrier team. Now, they all, they sort of run like the F-22 teams, where they grab whatever airplane is on the line and they take it to the air show and they demo it. But it'll be interesting what kind of force reductions get cut for the Navy. And that leaves the Army, and the Army might get rid of the Golden Knights. So three of the most important recruiting tools that the military has, I mean, that's the next step, is to eliminate the demo teams.
Actually, it's Greg Morris here for a second. One other point to make, too, is that the Air Force and the Navy always staffed the demo teams differently from a pilot standpoint. The Air Force has always assigned dedicated pilots to the demo team. In the Navy, all the pilots see flying the demos are instructors in either VFA-106, the East Coast Hornet Squadron, or VFA-122, the West Coast Squadron, who just volunteer to do this on their weekends in their own time.
Well, actually,
the Navy runs
they are
more pilots.
The Navy does provide you have to be a designated pilot. You have to be a designated demo pilot in the Navy, too.
That's correct, but it's not their only job. Yeah, one of my part-time guys was the CO that stood up the VFA-122 demo team, so he's been spinning me up on that for a while. But yeah, but it's, they're doing that on top of their normal job, as opposed to the Air Force, where it's all the demo pilots do for the terms of that assignment.
Yeah, that's interesting.
We're losing a valuable, vital recruiting tool, and it's unfortunate that our politicians can't figure out how to stop spending money and earn some, and the net result is the general public loses something very important.
Well, presumably, if the funding issues get resolved, this could get turned back on as fast as it was shut off, I imagine.
Once something goes away in the military, very rarely does it come back.
Oh, so you think we run the risk of losing this permanently, huh?
It's pretty good. I would say that there's a good chance that you will never see another, unless somewhere, somehow, someone starts squirting the rules. But this has come down from the highest levels that they're done. I don't think we're going to get them anymore. What you might see is, if you're at a base that has F-15s, they might do a heritage flight with the base Air 15s, but you won't actually see a demo team. The net result is the civilian air shows out there, like Oshkosh or any of the air shows that are run at private airfields or regional airports or such, if they don't get the Thunderbirds or the Blue Angels, they don't get a jet team.
Well, David, you're not often wrong, but I think we all hope that you're wrong this time. Again, our guest this episode is Greg Morris from Gauntlet Warbirds. Greg, you know, I have one question right from the start that I've always wondered. You described the aircraft that you guys have and that you fly. Where do these planes come from? How do you get a hold of a fleet of such interesting aircraft?
Actually, that's actually the easiest part of it. Acquiring the aircraft is just like buying any other general aviation aircraft. They're usually private party sales. For example, if you want to get an L-39, there's about 300 of them in the country right now, and a good number available. You're going to look at different brokers than you would than for some typical general aviation aircraft. You don't want to find a specialty broker. We're lucky in Chicago. We've got one of the largest ones in the country, the largest in the country, right in our backyard. It's Mark Clark out of Courtesy Aircraft out of Rockford. But acquiring the aircraft is actually straightforward. The difficulty in the purchase process comes in and making sure you're getting a good airplane, because there's some different sorts of things you need to look at to make sure that the aircraft has both been treated well and is going to accomplish your mission. You know, for example, I occasionally get folks calling asking for a T-6, and they go, I want an airplane with no damage history. Great, that's impossible. No
yeah,
such thing.
Don't exist.
All been ground looped.
Now, there's quite a few other pilots and instructors in that organization. Where do they come from?
getting the aircraft is the easiest part. Finding the instructors is the hardest part. I use a combination. We've got a number, some full-time instructors and some part-time instructors as well. And we use a combination of bringing people in from the outside who've got the right skill set and also training folks from the inside, you know, folks that we know and are going to be good assets. They're good instructors, and getting them the experience they need to be able to teach in the aircraft. Whenever we bring on a new staff member, I start them off as a demo pilot for essentially a one-year probationary period, doing rides in either the Extra 300 or the T6. And after that, if they're good, we'll move them up into instructor pilot status. The largest challenge we have is just finding guys with a tailwheel experience. If you want to get into this business, get tailwheel time. If somebody walks through the door, sends me a resume, and I see they've got 100 hours of tailwheel time, they go right to the top of the stack.
Oh, interesting. How about you, Rob? Have you got much tailwheel time?
Let's see. Tailwheel is what we used to call wheel on the wrong end of the airplane, I think.
That's the right end.
The right end, yeah. No, actually, I have a fair amount. I owned a baby decathlon. They used to call it the Citabria. They're still around, but I owned one of those for about 4 years, and it was just, it's a great airplane, but nothing will teach somebody how to make, say, crosswind landings or maintain directional control on the ground like a tail dragger. And I also taught in a Cessna 120 for a long time. So, you know, it's a challenge, but it's the kind of challenge that tailwheel pilots will say make real pilots.
Yeah, so Rob, you send me a resume, it'll go to the top of the stack. Then we got to talk about the aerobatic experience. The next thing we look at.
Yeah, but then there are those people that get sick real easy when they're upside down.
So, Greg, is most of your business training, or is it in the rides?
The majority of the business is training. We certainly do rides as well. But absolutely, our focus, our mission is to train pilots how to operate these aircraft, both initial and recurrent. As, you know, we're talking about, you know, American going bankrupt. You know, the big change we've seen in the warbird universe in the last 15 years is who owns the aircraft. If you were good, so you go to Oshkosh, 1990, 1995, you got a lot of airline pilots there bringing their aircraft. That has changed, and it means that a business like mine needs to exist both for training but also for ongoing support for aircraft owners who may not have as much time. They may not be professional pilots, and we provide, you know, one kind of one-stop shopping for everything you need and resources and connections. You know, right now we're helping export one aircraft to the UK, getting another one in from France, you know, and just, you know, said purchases on consulting, things like that. So there's the training is certainly a key element of it, but making the entire ownership experience pleasant and enjoyable is a whole other thing. And taking care of an aircraft that's 70 years old does bring up some unique challenges. Even just finding the right mechanic to take care of a World War II airplane.
Oh, I would imagine, yeah. So do you become experts in those particular aircraft, or do you have to rely on other folks to have that expertise for maintenance and all the other support issues?
For maintenance and things like that, we actually do not have maintenance in-house in the company for exactly that reason you mentioned, because with the variety of aircraft we have in the fleet, no single mechanic who can adequately take care of those airplanes. So we have different mechanics that take care of each type of aircraft that we have. We seek out, you know, the best folks for the T6 or the Stearman or the Decathlons, the Extras, the L39, and go to them instead of trying to have a single, you know, jack of all trades but master of none in-house. And that's, again, part of what you'll provide for an owner is getting them connected with those resources. Even insurance. If you call the wrong insurance agent to get your, you know, your T6 insured, you're going to pay twice what you would if you call a specialty agent.
Now, how broadly geographically do you have to go to get that that support? I mean, I imagine all these folks aren't right around the Chicago area, or are they?
That's exactly right. It depends. We're lucky in Chicago. Chicago has actually an outstanding and very deep network for warbirds. The furthest we take aircraft for maintenance is the T6 goes up to Sam Tabor at Tab Air in East Troy, Wisconsin. He runs an amazing shop that just does World War II aircraft. So even just going in and walking through the two hangars he has up there is always fantastic. There's at least one Mustang sitting up there at any time. You open the door, he's there, just, you know, got the engine off of Corsair. It's cool taking the airplane for an oil change. I always enjoy that. But so maintenance we keep relatively close. Things like insurance, it's a national market. Our insurance agent, one of our agents, is in Arizona. But you need to look nationally for the resources you're going to need to support and operate the aircraft.
I was going to ask something too, though, Greg. Do you find... This is, you know, because you and I know each other from back in the old days when we were both in the Commemorative Air Force. But anyway, this is a whole different kind of
Okay, stop it right there.
Okay.
Don't ever use those terms on this podcast ever again.
Commemorative Air Force?
Yes, it's the Confederate Air Force, and that's the way it always should be. Enough rant over.
I have to struggle not to say Confederate Air Force, to tell you the truth.
Let's compromise on CAF.
Yes, CAF. But it's a whole different kind of flying, fun, clubby experience. And do you market differently to this kind of crowd than, say, just a regular flying club?
You do have to market a bit differently, but to be honest, society's kind of done that for you. Talking about the demo teams, everybody goes to air shows. You know, not many people got excited and wanted to learn to fly by watching a 172 do a low pass. A whole bunch more people wanted to learn to fly watching a P-51 do the same thing. So what we offer is helping people bridge that gap between the desire to do something and the actual ability to. What we find more than anything is that people talk themselves out of the ability to fly or own and operate warbirds by assuming it's either more expensive or more difficult than it actually is.
Greg, you know, of all the emails I get, probably the category I get the most is people who are looking for warbird rides. And typically it's, you know, the spouse or children of someone that they're trying to give a gift to. And then they ask me, you know, where can they find a jet to ride in? And I think a lot of folks don't realize just how expensive, you know, these kinds of rides are because of how expensive these aircraft are to maintain. Tell us a little bit about the rides and how much those cost and what kinds of warbird rides are right for which kinds of people and which ones are not.
Certainly, yeah. Rides are a key component of the business, and they're a blast to do. I actually had the privilege about a little over a year ago of taking a gentleman flying for his 90th birthday, who was a Tuskegee Airman and P-51 pilot during the war. I mean, shot down an ME-109 over Italy. He had not touched an AT-6 since advanced training at Tuskegee. And
wow.
I can't trade that for anything. We get a huge number of inquiries, obviously, along the same lines. People wanting to get a ride for themselves, for a spouse, for a father, a grandfather. And the rides themselves, you know, we try to make it as hands-on as possible. We want people to be able to fly the aircraft for everything but the takeoff and landing. Our pilots are instructors. And if they want to do aerobatics on the ride, they can as well. It's all tailored to the customer's preferences. It is often more expensive than people expect. A ride in the T-6, for example, a 30-minute flight is $420 at Gauntlet. 40 minutes is $520. And it's just operating expense. I wish I had a huge net sitting on that. Now, you mentioned before people wanting to fly jets, and that's actually an inquiry we get quite often. Top Gun came out 25 years ago now, and there's a whole bunch of people who want to get jet rides. And the L-39 is just a flame drawing moths to it. And it is not legal in the U.S. to give a ride in an experimental aircraft. And that would include the L-39. We can offer training to pilots, but you cannot offer rides in jets in the U.S. And it's silly. To be honest, I think it's FAA protectionism, protecting people from themselves. The FAA has said that the public won't understand the difference between an L-39 and a 737 as far as certification and thus safety. Huh. And that really doesn't give people a whole lot of credit in my book, but I'll avoid the rant for a second.
I also understand at Gauntlet that you have a jet club. Is this like a fractional kind of a program?
Exactly, yeah. That's a program that we're actually just launching to help people get into these aircraft and to be able to own and operate, starting off with the jets and moving into other warbirds in essentially a fractional model, taking some of the best elements of a flying club and then a traditional flat fractional program. Because as an extension of the owners of these aircraft changing, many people now want a managed experience in owning and operating the airplane, where you get there, the maintenance is taken care of, it's ready to go fly and go have your fun, give it back, and then head home and let somebody else deal with getting in the hangar and putting gas in it.
Now, to me, the obvious question that we haven't asked yet is, which of these are your favorite?
That is a very difficult question. I usually say it depends on my mood. If somebody was going to put a gun to my head and say you can only fly one type of aircraft for the rest of your career, I've got to go with the T-6. It is a wonderful aircraft. It is a challenge to fly. It is a joy to fly every single time. And it is such a privilege to get to fly a piece of history like that. And we have two T-6, actually SNJs, the Navy version of the aircraft. We have two of them in the business now, built in 1944. You know, you can contact the Smithsonian, get the history of them. And the T-6 is honestly every bit as fun as the fighters, with just lower numbers on the airspeed indicator.
Mm-hmm.
and a heck of a lot less acquisition and operating expense. But the T-6 is a joy. The L-39 is certainly a wonderful aircraft. I love flying that as well, too. I like teaching in the L-39 actually more than just flying it, getting to help people make that transition into jets. And most of our clients coming into the L-39 have no prior jet experience. It's usually their first airplane. And it's a perfect first jet to fly. If you were going to learn to fly in the Russian Air Force today, you'd learn in an L-39, and they'd expect you to solo after 15 hours of flying time.
Wow.
So it's got good handling qualities, nice aircraft, very modern systems. It's a Czech airplane, and it's the best of Eastern and Western engineering combined.
David, let me ask you, if you had an opportunity to fly one of these airplanes in this Gauntlet Warbirds fleet, which one would you pick?
I'm kind of a sucker for radials. I kind of like the idea of going for a ride in a Texan.
Okay. How about you, Rob?
The jet is pretty cool, but somehow when you start up a radial engine airplane, unlike David, you know, you hear that crank and the smoke comes out the back. And, and David, you have to have a scarf on that blows in the wind because you have the canopy open. And, it doesn't get a whole lot better than that.
The really sad, pathetic point is my second choice in that would be the Stearman.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to go out and fly open cockpit, there's nothing like flying in a Stearman.
Yeah, the Stearman would be my first choice, actually. How about you, Dan? Anything in this fleet that interests you?
I think
other than the be right back that he just sent.
Oh, did he? Oh, I didn't see that.
So,
sorry.
I think we should pick for Dan. I think, Greg, do you have a Cessna 150?
You know, we do not, unfortunately. We'll have to get one just for him.
Oh, okay. We need the docile airplane for. Actually, it just has to have a big, comfortable seat.
You know, since Dan stepped away and he's not here to hear this, maybe, you know, we need to get him a graduation present, coming up next year. Maybe a ride would be a good choice.
I'm obviously a little biased, but we could make that happen.
He'd have to get his butt out to Chicago, but I think we could. I think that would be a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah, I think we could arrange that.
Said this. Are you going to let this run on the air, Max, or will you chop this part out?
I think
somebody else tells him something about this. It won't be a surprise anymore.
Nah, we'll tell all of our listeners. Don't tell Dan.
Okay, don't tell Dan, everybody.
Okay.
And it's safe because he doesn't listen to the show.
Well, he listens to the outtakes. I know that for a fact.
Actually, I have one question for Greg, too. Have you had anybody come to you for either a ride or for training that, you know, started this and said, wow, this is way different than what I thought, and I really don't like this?
The answer is yes and no. We get a lot of people that come through the door where the experience is different than what they expect, but universally it's always better than they expect, or it is just different. Especially the T-6, the aircraft vibrates, it's noisy, you can fly with the canopy open. People aren't expecting it to be as visceral a flying experience as it is, but they universally say it's even better than they thought it was going to be. So we've never had somebody, because by the time somebody gets to me, they've self-selected a little bit, and that there's certainly an interest, and they've sought this out, they've put some money on the table, and we're going to go make it happen. You know, we've called them the night before to check the weather, helped them find the office at Aurora, and they're excited. It's a pleasure to get to do this. It's a lot more fun, honestly, than giving intro rides in a Cessna, not because of the aircraft, but because the level of enthusiasm and passion people have for these aircraft is absolutely infectious.
Oh, that's interesting.
One thing we have to mention, Greg, like I said, you and I, when was the CF? It was maybe 5 years ago?
6 years ago.
Tell everybody what you were doing in addition to flying when you and I first met.
Oh, actually, I just moved back from California. I got my engineering degree in California and then moved back to Chicago for law school, which was a horrible misstep I've luckily remedied.
Yeah, I think you're on the right path now.
This is a little more fun, yeah.
Yeah, I would say so. Greg, thanks for coming on the show. We really appreciate you spending the time with us. Tell folks where they can find Gauntlet Warbirds on the web.
If you go to gauntletwarbirds.com or just Google search Gauntlet Warbirds, our website will pop right up, and we'd love to hear from you and take folks flying.
Fantastic. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
And now with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode number 35, December 1st through December 10th. December 1st, 1933. Indian National Airways begins service. The flight service includes a daily service from Calcutta to Dhaka and Calcutta to Rangoon. The flights use a de Havilland Dragon six-seater. The flight is a total of 25 rupees. The Dragon was state-of-the-art, according to their timesheet, equipped with wireless. Who knew in the 30s they were so advanced? December 5th, 1921. Wounded World War I veteran Norman Brearley starts his own airline. Western Australian Airlines was formed using grants to fly airmail. Brearley was actually the first person to be licensed to fly in Australia commercially. He received ticket number 2. Number 1 actually was given to Amy Johnson in the 30s due to her record flight from London to Perth. Western Australian Airlines, or Airlines as everyone called it, first paying flight was not really what I would call a success. The flight, using a Bristol Tourer, G-A-U-D-I, crashed 130 kilometers north of Geraldton. So not a good first flight for an airline. December 10th, 2004, the Federal Aviation Administration issues an AD, an Emergency Airworthiness Directive, for all T-34 Mentor aircraft, effectively grounding the whole fleet in the United States. The T-34, as a warbird, was suffering wing spars during mock dogfights. The AD was finally lifted this year in 2011. First flights that occurred during the week of December 1st through December 10th. Okay, folks, it's 10 days. Just stick with me. December 1st, 1945, the Republic RC-3CB. December 2nd, 1948, the Beechcraft T-34 Mentor. December 2nd, 1979, the Gulfstream 3. December 6th, 1981, the Dornier DO-328. December 6th, 1993, the Bombardier CL-415 Super Scooper. Evidently, December 6th is a day for amphibians to be tested. December 7th, 1942, Pearl Harbor Day. Bell's P-63 King Cobra first flew. And December 8th seems to be a day for Bell aircraft. The Bell 47, otherwise known as the OH-13 Sioux, December 8th, 1945. The Bell 206, otherwise known as the Jet Ranger or the OH-58A Kiowa, December 8th, 1962. And December 8th, 2000, the Bell AH-1Z Viper, the four-bladed Super Cobra, Super Cobra. And on December 10th, 1938, the Lockheed Hudson Mark I. And that's the way it was, December 1st through the 10th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Thanks, David. A Super Scooper, huh? Is that a firefighting aircraft or something?
The CL-215 and 415, the 415 is the turboprop, was originally built by Canadair as literally a firefighter. It was designed as an amphibian that has a scoop that drops out the bottom belly of the aircraft, and it goes along and scoops up the water and then goes dumps it on fires. Kind of like the opening of Always, where the PBY comes down to scoop up water on the lake and the two guys go swimming. One of my favorite images in that whole movie.
Great. Okay, thanks again, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, December 4th, 2011.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 176. And boy, Grant, do I feel superior this week.
Oh, really? What's got your superiority gland kicking in?
I've now got an instructor's rating.
Really?
Yes.
You've gone straight to instructor? How'd you manage that?
Yes, for trains.
Oh, well, you know, it's still big, dangerous, and kills people. So, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yes, I should have joined the army. You know what, Grant? I think I should have a new title. I was thinking something rather Star Wars-esque.
What, like Obi-Wan?
Well, that'll do.
So you're going to be Obi-Wan. You're going to breathe deep, consult, become one with the inner force and spread the word of peace, love, and harmony and driving trains to your Padawan learners.
Let me just try this, Grant. I'll just wave my hand in a big swish like this and say, you don't wish to talk to Dan Webb.
I don't wish to talk to Dan Webb.
See, brilliant. Brilliant.
This isn't the podcast I'm looking for.
That's exactly right.
Oh, hey, what the hell?
All right, then. Well, look, speaking of things that perhaps they're not looking for, Qantas. Maybe they're not looking for Asia.
Are we going a little bit more Sith on our Jedi move? So, yes, speaking of Sith, they reckon they're not going to do the Asian premium carrier. That's the rumor going around. A couple of sources within Qantas have said this. But Joyce is, of course, denying it. He's saying that they do still want to proceed with a premium Asian offering. However, they appear to be doing a lot more work on trying to set up a code share alliance with Malaysian Airlines.
Well, if that's the case, and I mean, nobody really knows. There's a lot of reports going around at the moment, Grant. To me, it would make more sense to do a code share type of thing.
Well, given the final barriers have all been knocked down and approval has all been given for Virgin and Singapore Airlines to get their alliance underway, which is code shares, frequent flyer points, bookings, all that kind of stuff, all like their one airline, that full alliance, then yeah, Qantas is trying to make that happen. They are working on those kind of things. But they'd been talking about how they were going to get all these A320neos. They were going to hook them up with premium lie-flat seats that were going to be even bigger than the ones used in the A380s. I'm not sure how they're going to make that work in a single-aisle aircraft, but they were going to go with this premium approach and fly them all over Asia when the aircraft don't really have the range to get from Melbourne or all the way up past Kuala Lumpur and beyond. It's really quite odd. The word that's coming out is that they're saying they're not going to do it because of the global financial crisis and things aren't really good. And it's like, well, hang on, we've known about that for a while. We've known things aren't getting better in a hurry. So, mate, it's like the whole takeover rumor that's resurfaced. There's a lot of stuff going around. Qantas have forecast a big profit drop, but despite all this, the share price actually went up a little, which if there is a takeover being planned by people like Jeff Dixon and co, then that must really be annoying them.
Well, look, let's move on to talking about stuff that our historian hates us talking about, and that's tankers.
Oh, no.
Excuse me, did somebody say tanker?
Oh, David.
Well, oh, my
goodness, I didn't know you were lurking there. Great timing, mate. We thought we'd talk very quickly about the Royal Australian Air Force's KC-30 air-to-air tanking trials beginning.
Trials and tribulations, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Nothing good can come out of a tanker program.
Yeah, no, what's happening is the RAF are going to use their KC-30s that they have now accepted, and they've started trials with a F-18 Hornet out of the Aircraft Research and Development Unit.
Yeah, and they're using a B Hornet, two-seat, so if when one of your guys takes out the drogue, it'll take out two people. Smart move, guys.
Yeah,
but you got to have someone in the back filming.
That's it. Probably another one of those lucky photographers from Australian Aviation. Grant, how come we never get a Guernsey like that?
I don't know. Maybe we just haven't been around long enough. They've been in the gig for ages.
Yeah, well, lucky guys. Anyway, David, all jokes aside about tankers, I'm intrigued about the history of probe and drogue refueling versus the boom. I mean, for the Royal Australian Air Force, they need to have both. Now they've got the C-17s, but, you know, is there a sort of a long history about how these two methods came about?
Well, it's a chicken and the egg, but really it's the drogue method is the earliest way to deliver fuel from one aircraft to another. If you go back in time, back to the 30s, the probe or drogue was a guy throwing a hose from one airplane down to the other airplane, and the guy in the bottom airplane put the hose in the gas tank. So that's early probe and drogue refueling. In the 50s, probe and drogue was the primary method to transfer fuel. It requires more piloting skill than it does for a boom receptacle. It was Boeing that created the boom. And the reason why is things like B-52s cannot wait around all day long while a little bit of gas goes through hoses. So it's a high-speed boom. That's the main difference. The majority of the world's aircraft and air forces use probe and drogue. Only very few countries have the ability to use boom technology.
Well, it's typically the larger aircraft, because exactly what you're talking about, it's like bandwidth on your internet. You need a big pipe to shove as much fuel down. Otherwise, like you said, a B-52 would be hanging around there burning almost as much fuel as it's receiving on the drogue.
That's absolutely right, and it's a really good analogy about bandwidth. Probe and drogue means there's more capabilities, like the ability of an F-18F to refuel another F-18F, which comes in handy when you've got 36 of them on the deck of an aircraft carrier.
No, we're not going down
did
there.
Did I say
you
that?
Slam us again. Look, you know, we got that disrespect from last week, David. We get it.
But yeah, the Navy are big on the probe and drogue for exactly that. The buddy refuel, or any aircraft can become a tanker for any other aircraft, things like that. It's quite a compact method of transferring, and you don't need a dedicated resource, which on a carrier is really important. And because we're like the Kiwis with their A4s and now us with our F-18s, we're using what was originally set up as a carrier aircraft. We've naturally gone with the probe and drogue.
But you've got C-17s coming, and more importantly, I don't know what fit you're getting with your F-35As, whether you're going to get probe and drogue or boom receptacles. Yeah. So your Lightning IIs are coming down the pipe, and I believe the A version is a boom receptacle refueler. I don't know if the option is to add the probe and drogue to that aircraft or not. So there are a lot of countries worldwide, like Japan, like Italy, that are setting up boom tankers because of their future in F-35s.
Well, speaking of other aircraft militarily in Australia, of course, the other one that's made the headlines this week is the MRH-90s that have hit the government's projects of concern list. And, of course, that's for the Australian Army. So, Grant, what's happening there?
Basically, the MRH-90 project has been delayed and had some problems. Once they start having some issues and delays and things like that, the Australian Defence Force have worked with the minister to create a projects of concern list. There's been a variety of projects on there, including the Wedgetail has recently come off. This is a list where basically there's way more attention being paid between the minister, the Defence Department, and the military, and the contractors and so on. And they're really looking into what's got to be done to fix it. So what the impact of this is that it's going to delay the replacement of the Black Hawk and the Sea Kings.
David, are you up on the MRH-90? Do they use them over there?
No, it's not a helicopter currently used in the United States inventory. It's a more of a European program. We've never really been involved with the MRH-90. We were involved with the larger brother of it, which was going to, for a while, to be produced by Lockheed Martin as Marine One, which is the Cormorant and the EH-101. But we don't have the MRH-90. The class of helicopter we use would be the UH-60 family for that involvement and that type of operation.
Well, the upshot is that we've got 14 delivered as yet. The project's running late and we're watching it. But the other project of a similar manufacturer that was on the projects of concern list that just came off is the Tiger armed recon helicopter. That's finally come off the list because the last one's been delivered.
Well, that's one way to get it off the list.
Actually deliver something.
Yeah, it's sort of worked with Wedgetail as well.
Well, it's been a great session talking about defense, David. We should have you lurking in the background more often, just in case we inadvertently start talking about tankers. But, mate, I must compliment you on that fantastic lightsaber work you've been practicing.
Well, I've had some lessons.
Next time, can you just knock? I mean, now we've got to replace the door and some of that new soundproofing that Steve just put in the studio.
It cost me a fortune to put that up.
But it was so much fun taking it down.
Yeah, there we are.
I think I'm in the presence of a pair of Sith. Normally, there's only ever two Sith, the Master and the Apprentice. But where's that leave me? I want to be a Sith.
We'll just start calling you General Grievous, prop boy.
Hey, I've flown in the jet.
All right, before it gets ugly here, we're going to wrap it up. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
I'm still Grant McCarran.
And he's
David Vanderhoof.
Cheers, folks.
Yeah, I've heard of that guy.
Hey, I thought I was David Vanderhoof.
No, I'm David Vanderhoof.
No, hang on. I thought I was Max Flight.
Does he get paid more to be on that show too?
David did a great job.
Hey, listen, you know, I just wanted to make mention of something that happened over here while I was in Paris the other day. We got this special delivery package from Australia, and someone that claims to be from the Plain Crazy Down Under folks sent our family some extra packs of Tim Tams. Which were going down very nicely. So, and of course, if you don't know what those are,
rub it in.
You get to be on the show. I get the goodies.
Can you get Tim Tams anywhere in the U.S.?
I don't
actually. Pepperidge Farm makes them. If you look, you'll be able to find them because Pepperidge Farm did make Tim Tams. For our listeners, Tim Tams are these amazing chocolate little things, cookie things that come from Australia that are, when served with coffee or frozen, are quite the delicacy.
Except you have to eat them upside down.
All right. One thing I'd like to do is close out the grill question that Stephen Grant asked. If you'll recall, a few episodes ago, they asked our listeners a little trivia question. They asked which airplane geeks episode was there a cameo appearance by a Cylon? And no one's got the answer right. We have one person, Alex from China, came closest with episode 101. But in fact, it was episode 100. And Steve sent along a little proof.
Do you think, can you hear the butler coming down the corridor?
It looks like they're doing it in a century theme, or actually he's a centurion theme. Let's see what he has to say, Grant.
Strike him, centurion, very awfully.
It's true. He looks like he's in a grumpy mood, mate. Or maybe Max has got the heavies.
Oh, I don't know. Nah, if he's got the heavies, you know what kind of centurion he's going to have.
Oh, hang on, here's another one. Excuse me, sir. Show me into where Max Flight is, please. Ah, that's more like it.
Much better. At last, somebody who understands authority and respects it.
Yes. All right, folks. Well, we're going to go off and join the 100 episodes.
All right, there it was from episode 100.
God, the... that was...
Oh, yeah.
A long time ago.
That wasn't too...
That's a long time ago when, God, I was young and had and had slightly...
could not consume adult beverages.
Yeah, and had slightly less gray hair.
Yeah.
Next, can we grill the geeks? Oh, no, we have Across the Pond, don't we?
Now here's Peter Johnson, Across the Pond.
With Thanksgiving behind us, and with the festive season rapidly approaching, I thought about some of the people that I wanted to thank and be grateful for. Recently, I've met many pilots, and some of which I can now call friends, and I'm very grateful for all the work that they do, and for, more importantly, the healthy and safe record. A while ago, I talked on the podcast about the European Union and new safety rules that it was making amendments to, and these were leading to longer flying time and longer working time for British airline pilots. I still find this totally unacceptable, and I unashamedly now play the British Airline Pilots Association response to this.
A message from Britain's airline pilots. It seems like an obvious thing to say, but a tired pilot is a dangerous pilot. That's why there are rules that dictate just how long a pilot is allowed to fly before he or she is deemed unable to fly safely. The rules in the UK are very strict and have been developed over many years of study and scientific observation. Consequently, here in the UK, we have one of the best air safety records in the world. Unfortunately, that could all change if new EU rules regarding this issue come into force in 2012. On the face of it, applying one consistent set of rules throughout Europe would appear to make sense. In reality, the proposed rules would have our pilots flying dangerously tired. Independent scientific research shows us that the new rules would have our pilots landing aircraft in a state of fatigue tantamount to being four times over the legal blood alcohol limit for flying. Scary, isn't it? The airline industry, however, seems rather keen on the new proposals. The recession has put financial pressure on many airlines, understandably leading to their desire for increased staff productivity. They see the new rules as a way to achieve their productivity targets. A terribly misguided and potentially fatal mistake. Since the Colgan air crash in Buffalo, New York, a crash which killed 50 people and in which pilot fatigue was understood to be a cause, the Americans are tightening considerably the rules governing pilot flying hours. Europe can't be allowed to move in the opposite direction. We can't allow a fatal accident to be the spur that secures safe regulations for the UK and, indeed, the rest of Europe. There will be nearly 2 million flights in and out of the UK this year. As pilots, we want to make sure every single one of those flights is as safe as it can possibly be. Please help us to do that. Sign our petition on flight safety and pilot fatigue on the government e-petition website. You can access it via flightsafetypetition.co.uk. Then forward this video to everyone you know. And please remember, a tired pilot is a dangerous pilot.
Since I've become involved in this and this issue's become more public, I've had the opportunity to talk to a couple of airline pilots about what they genuinely feel the effect of this legislation will be. And I'd like to think that most pilots are relatively level-headed and open-minded. However, in this instance, I can't find anyone who thinks this is a good idea, and I genuinely believe that they're being honest when they say to me it's not the right thing to do. Again, I'll let you make your own minds up. And if you feel strongly enough about this, please support the online petition. Now to something closer to home. The second thing I want to give thanks for are some of the contributions that are made to getting these aviation podcasts out to you, the listeners, the audience, the participants. Every now and then, we do get very positive and sometimes not so positive feedback about the work that we do. However, there's one individual without whom this podcast would never exist, and that individual is Max. He spends hours and hours and hours of his own time editing, arranging interviews, setting things up, helping me out and helping others out to make this a reality. We have about 5,000 listeners every week to this program, and only a few ever give us our feedback. So here's my plea. I'd like to openly thank Max for all the work he's done, not only this year, but in the countless other years in delivering this podcast. Now, over to you. Don't sit there and think someone else will write in, but why not show your support for the work that Max does? Come onto our Facebook page and show him how much we appreciate the work he does. And finally, a shout out. Supporting what I was saying earlier, there's another individual who makes a massive contribution, not only to this podcast, but to many others, including his own podcast, and that's Steve Vischer. The amount of time that Steve invests, not only in PCDU, but in supporting me and supporting other aviation podcasts, can't be underestimated. So again, a big shout out to Steve for all the support and guidance that he's given me. To Rob, Dan, Grant and David, why not show them how much you appreciate the work that gets done? I know this is an unusual segment, but every now and then you've got to come above the parapet and show your true colours. So please show the team how much you appreciate the work they do as we go into the festive season. And of course, don't forget, please sign the petition.
Wow. Thank you, Peter.
Well, see, now I can't do anything. Because if I do anything out of gratitude, it's because people will think that it's forced and canned because Peter forced me to. So
we call that guilt.
Yeah, so now it's ruined. So, yeah.
Well, I liked it anyway, Peter.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter.
If you're hearing the Angry Birds, that means it's time for the newest feature here on the Airplane Geeks. We call this segment Grill the Geeks. Here's how it works. Each week, you, our faithful listeners, will attempt to stump us with your questions. Well, if you're ready for the ultimate test of wits, send your questions to thegeeks at airplanegeeks.com. Each week, we'll randomly draw questions from those we receive. Unless, of course, you're the only person that week who had the nerves of steel needed to challenge us. And if you stump us, you'll win not one, but two official Airplane Geeks buttons. Buttons you can wear proudly around your local airport, proclaiming that you're obviously way smarter than we ever thought anyone who listened to this show could ever be. So if you're ready to match us brain cell for brain cell, send those questions to thegeeks at airplanegeeks.com. We'll be waiting.
All right.
And of course, what that explains is why I had trouble meeting girls when I was young.
Okay.
I didn't get out enough.
Well, to kick off the Grill the Geek segment, we got an email from Tom. Now, you recall last time we did this, we had a little question about the F-104 Starfighter versus the F-106 Delta Dart. And this was an answer to Tom's question about the aircraft to hold three records.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tom writes, "My apologies for the mistake on the answer to the aircraft to first hold the three records. It was the F-104 Starfighter." He says, "It was a mental mistake, as I'm building an F-106 Delta Dart model currently and had the name mix up. Good job, Rob, on the answer." So just to clarify that.
Yeah, well, you know, every so often, what is that, the second time I've gotten one right, I think? But that's okay.
I think, you know, it was. It happens. All right. First one comes from Philippe.
Where's Philippe from?
I don't know. Philippe. I do know Philippe is from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Okay, he's got a couple of things in here, but let me just do this one. He says, I'd like to ask a question. What is the name? Here it is. What is the name of an extinct Brazilian airline that was owned by a big U.S. airline, which is currently extinct? Now, Greg, God. You can play along, too, if you know the answer.
Yeah, I think I'm going to leave this one to you guys.
I mean, I remember Varig going bust, but they weren't owned by a U.S. carrier as far as I know.
And is Avianca still? No, Avianca's gone, right?
Avianca is still around, but they're not Brazilian. They're Colombian.
Oh, right. I knew that. I was just testing to see if Dan knew that.
I don't know. I really don't know South American airlines that well.
Was there ever an airline called Brazillo? Okay, Brazillo? I made that up.
I think you
I
did.
Mean, what the hell? Let's go with Brazillo as the answer.
No.
I mean, I really only know Varig, but I'm 90% sure that's not the answer, but that's the only guess I have.
Okay, let me open Philippe's email.
So Brazillo is wrong, right?
I'm sure it is.
Okay. All right, Philippe, I was just having you on. I think Philippe looks like he's going to win a couple of buttons.
Huh. The answer is Panair do Brasil, or
owned
Panair
by
of
Pan
Brazil.
Am.
Ah.
The airline started as NYBRA do Brasil, a subsidiary of New York, Rio, Buenos Aires line. So that's the answer, Panair.
And was part of Pan Am?
It was part of Pan Am.
I'll be darned.
Why I kept my mouth shut, because I knew the answer.
Why did you give the answer? This is the whole point of the thing. One of the key
because you guys always I always get the questions. You guys were fuddling for it.
And then I say I don't know, and then Rob, you come in. You could have been my white knight, and then we wouldn't have to pay I'm postage.
Well, I was pretty close with Brazillo.
We're really close with Brazillo.
Yeah. Okay. I guess this means we're going to have to send Philippe. Philippe, send us his address?
I don't think so.
Okay, I'll Philippe,
you have
that.
To send us your address, bud.
Meanwhile, David, bro, you're killing me.
I know. Oh,
anyway.
All right, so here's the next one. This is from Desmond. Desmond is from New Zealand. Ah, here's an easy question for Dan.
Which means I'll probably get it wrong, but continue.
All right, here's the question. Tasman Empire Airways Limited, TEAL, and National Airways Corporation, NAC, are two former airlines that are now known as what?
Come on, dude. If you don't know this, I'll have to bail your sorry butt out.
Okay, hon.
You want me to repeat that, or you got
I'm going to guess Air New Zealand, but I really don't know.
Air New Zealand is the answer.
Oh, thank God.
Teal was renamed in 1965 to Air New Zealand.
That Dan is good. He's not just another pretty face.
All right.
Okay, we're one for one. We got one more. And folks, I want you to know that Max hasn't gotten any. I just want you to know that.
Yeah.
This is from Matthew.
Do we know where Matthew's from? Yeah, we should tell people when they send questions in, they should tell us what.
Yeah, that would be nice, because I don't know where Matthew's from. He says, this one is for Rob and Max. Uh-oh. You might like to get your heads together to figure it out. I'm sure you will. Uh-oh. Two questions regarding the Dassault Falcon 20. Boy, the Falcon 20 was released in 1963 with GE C700-2D engines. From about 1970 onwards, many of these were replaced with Garrett TFE 731s, which is a geared turbofan. All right, two-part question. Ugh. A, what other design feature is different between the C700-2D and the Garrett engine, making the C700-2D almost unique? And the second part of that was, why was the retrofit popular?
Well, my guess is the retrofit was popular because it burned a heck of a lot less fuel than the GEs did by a long shot. But I don't know, maybe that's not even right. Maybe there was something else to it. But the first part of the question, Well, Max, this is why you're the engine guy, bud.
Yeah, but I'm big engines. These are like little engines.
Well, it's so now we're discriminatory when it comes to engines.
He's got engine envy.
He's got, yeah.
We do not discriminate on the basis of size or fuel flow. let me think about that. Why?
I think the key design change was one was awesomer than the other. You're welcome.
Yeah, I don't know.
Greg has a thought, though.
Could noise be part of that as well, too? You got a lot of noise abatement becoming kind of the vogue when that change is occurring as well.
That sounds like the most informed guess so far.
So if he gets it right, does Greg get a button?
Perhaps.
I guess we have to give him buttons.
We'll figure out a button exchange rate.
I don't know. Do we have the answer to that from Matthew?
So he did note that in a later email, he said he mistyped it. It should have been the GECF 700.
Oh, well, that just changes everything for me. I would have known the answer otherwise.
All right, so I've just opened up the email with the answer. And the answer for part A is that the CF 700 2D had a fan mounted at the rear of the power turbine. Oh, that's interesting.
Wow.
And he also says that for the second part B, why was the retrofit popular? He says the Garrett TFE 731 delivered 400 pounds more thrust for about half the SFC, which is specific fuel consumption.
So we sort of got the second part right.
Yeah, but we didn't know anything about the fan mounted at the rear of the power turbine.
You know what? That was I was just going to say that. I knew
you know what?
That is like kind of bizarre.
It is. I'm going to have to look that up. I'd like to see a photo of that.
All right.
Put the fan at the back.
Yeah.
I feel a little bad that we're 1-for-3. So we have one more. Maybe we can make it 2-for-4.
Do we have one more?
We would have been 2-for-3 if a certain Philadelphian chimed in.
That's true. All right. Look, there's one more. And this is from Micah. You're going to love this one. Our main man, Micah.
You're not funny.
That's how he signs his emails. This relates to geese. Remember we were talking about the possibility or the concept of airliners flying in V formations similar to how geese do? And that's sometimes called flocking and some other things. Well, this relates to that. Question, in a flight of geese in a normal V formation, one will often see that one side of the V is longer than the other. Why?
That's not even an airplane question.
Go ahead and try to answer it. I know what the answer is.
I don't know. Maybe
it's an odd. It's an even number of geese.
I mean, yes, that could happen.
You're kind of getting close.
I don't know.
Does it have anything to do with a political perspective that sometimes the geese lean more right than left?
Is there some way?
Rob's getting pretty close.
If one side is longer than the other, does it mean
the males are on the right, the females are on the left?
No, Dan got it. There's more geese on that side. That's the answer.
Oh.
Get out of here. Yes. You gotta be kidding me.
That's a statement of fact.
They said silly but true. All right, so Dan mentioned it. We kind of went in circles to get there, but
I was going to say maybe there was like a wind taking advantage or something. I don't know. By the way,
you're honestly telling me the answer is it's longer on one side because there are more geese on that side?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we're 2-for-4. By the way, I have a grill of listeners question. It's real quick.
Oh, I hope it's quick.
Yeah, I think it's time we started doing that. I think I like Dan's idea.
Okay. No prize or anything as usual, just the satisfaction. This U.S. airline was set to become the only U.S. operator of the Airbus A340 a few years ago. Tell me the airline, and you can get super self-esteem points or something if you can tell. Actually, I will send you a button if you can tell me under what circumstances this airline would have ordered the A340, what they were planning to use it for, and if you can tell me the one other North American operator of the Airbus A340. Other major operator. I think there's only one, but I'll hedge it by saying major.
Okay. All right, there it is. There's the quiz.
And maybe someday I'll come up with a question.
Oh, I'd be afraid of a question that you asked, David. No one, you could come up with a question that nobody could answer.
Well, here's one off the top of my head.
Okay, go ahead.
Being from Philadelphia, name the only aircraft built by a train company in World War II.
Oh, that's a good question. Okay, so there you have it, folks. Send your answers in if you know it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We have a ton of listener mail. We're not going to be able to cover all of it, unfortunately, but we'll take a stab at it. We got a comment from Chris Miller that he posted on airplanegeeks.com for episode 175. You recall from our Bits and Pieces episode last week that he had sent in the voicemail about the Bradley tarmac delays. Chris wrote in there, Rob, about the Bradley issue. The JetBlue pilot indicated, "Bring me a tow bar." That's a quote. Obviously, vehicles could move on the ramp or he would not have asked. I believe there was mention that there was already a stair at the airplane because the fire personnel were on board. So it is not an access problem. It seems to be a procedure problem. I suggest America's $1 million fine could purchase a lot of rolling stairs and some planning time to make sure every airport slash airline had a way to deal with more planes than gates.
I think the one thing I'll say about this, because we've beaten tarmac delays to death multiple times. I think it's just too early to make any conclusions here. Undoubtedly, in a few months, there'll be some kind of lengthy DOT report on exactly what happened.
I hope so.
So obviously, it's easy to say afterwards, especially if like people also podcast to Monday morning quarterback and say, "Well, this should have been fixed now." I think it's good if we just hold off, wait, let the government investigate this, and then we can talk.
I think you're letting them get off very easy, but that's just me.
Getting who off?
Letting the airport authority. I mean, I thought that point was well made. I was making the assumption that there was probably so much snow on the ground that nobody could even move, and obviously I didn't have that one right. So I do kind of wonder why, if they had stairs up to the airplane, why they couldn't figure out a way to get the folks off the airplane.
Yeah, I mean, I would understand it more if it was an international flight and it was a customs issue.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. These situations are weird, and a lot of times there's a snowball effect, so...
You know, I can smell an airline management guy getting in here somewhere. What do you guys think?
I think so.
Yeah, he's going to make a good one.
We got a couple of emails on the Messerschmitt 262 that we've talked about a little bit lately. One from Kevin, and this is pretty interesting. This is a description that he passed along from the ferry pilot on the ME-262. So I'll just read from this because it's pretty interesting. It says, after the successful completion of the flight test program and some bureaucratic and weather delays, I ferried the airplane from Payne Field, Washington, to Suffolk County Airport in Virginia. Now, this again is the Messerschmitt ME-262. For the last two test flights, we had converted it to a two-seat configuration, which allowed our lead mechanic to come along as crew chief and navigator on this 2,500-mile trip. As our FAA operating limitations mandated day VFR only, and the max altitude of 18,000 feet, not exactly optimal for range, it took us 4 days and 6 refueling stops across the continent to reach our destination, with White 3 performing flawlessly. Now, this is interesting. ATC doesn't have a computer code yet for the ME-262. Why would they? The controllers frequently ask me for the type of airplane. They usually couldn't wait then to pass the information on to their airliners on the same frequency. For example, Delta 123, you have a Messerschmitt in your 10 o'clock 5 miles. One of the funny replies, quote, "Are we being invaded?" This aircraft is going to end up at the Military Aviation Museum at Suffolk County, a small airport near Suffolk County, near Virginia Beach.
Yay!
So that's not too far. Well, that's kind of a few hours from you, David.
Well, it's 6, but I'm down there enough to go know that I will eventually get to see a flying ME-262. Not that I'm complaining about that.
So it's Greg. On the call sign issue, I've had that happen to me as well, too. I was ferrying a Wildcat from Houston to NAS Jacksonville for an air show last month.
Oh, yeah?
You keep getting called a cheetah or something like that. You call up Grumman. It's like, no, it's a Grumman, but it's not the one you're thinking of. And as soon as the controller figured out, they're doing the same thing. Yeah, you got a Wildcat on your 9 o'clock. Yeah, Continental 514.
Yeah.
They always get a kick of that. It's fun to talk to them.
Yeah, you can imagine that. Yeah. How often do they get that kind of thing? That's great. And then Ryan sent in some photos. He said he was he saw the ME-262 flying when he visited Payne Field in August. And he sent along some links to some really cool photos of this plane. So we'll put those in the show notes on airplanegeeks.com. You can look for those there. Let's see. Bob Iverson wrote in. Dan, do you want to take this one?
Bob writes, "Hi geeks, hope you all had a great Thanksgiving. Now back to work. Today's AP news story about several airlines grounding even more RJs because of their lousy fuel economy got me thinking. Are there more efficient jets in the 50 to 100 seat category? I believe that Bombardier C series are larger than most RJs, so what are regional carriers likely to do in the medium to long term? Cut flights but stay with RJs for smaller markets? Fly fewer flights with larger, more efficient planes? What makes more sense? Maybe a question for Dan. Keep up the great work on the podcast. It keeps getting better, Bob." So I emailed Bob about this. I did look at the article. I think a lot of what was in the AP article was kind of reviewing what's already happened, especially with very small RJs like the RJ-135, like that. I know... I think American Eagle has some of those that aren't flying right now, and there were some operating for Continental with ExpressJet that I'm pretty sure all those aren't flying anymore. So what's happened with the 50-seat RJ? It was a huge segment for growth. We'll call it a few years ago, but the economics of that segment kind of started changing when we saw really high fuel prices. So it's going to be. I hate saying the word now because people on Twitter keep pointing it out. Interesting to see what happens there, because the regional carriers are, I'm not sure if this is the best way to say it, are sort of shielded from reality in a way, because regional carriers, a lot of the very big regional agreements with mainland carriers are under capacity purchase agreements where capacity is locked up for years at a time. So the regional carrier really doesn't have much input where it comes to schedules or routes or stuff like that. They just, the capacity is purchased from the mainline carrier, and the regional carrier, their job is to run a good operation. So I think the 50 seat markets, it's very much up in the air right now, because you have these long-term deals that over the next few years more and more will start expiring, but at the same time you don't have any 50 seaters in production from Bombardier and Embraer. So carriers could go with a larger airplane, a 70-seater, like the CRJ-700 or the E-170 family, and now Embraer has announced that they're going to be re-engining that family for later this decade. But the issue is, which a topic that I just talked about earlier in the show, is the whole pilot scope clause thing, which is could restricts how much flying or what flying can be outsourced to regional carriers. It's one thing that scope clauses do. So that's a big question right now as well, because American pilots, they've been negotiating for years, and now that whole process is going to be a little bit messy with bankruptcy. And now United's and Continental's pilots, they're working on a joint contract. And then U.S. Airways, that whole pilot thing has been messy for a good 6 years now. And Delta's pilot contract, I believe, becomes amendable at the very end of next year. So you have all these mainline pilot contracts that either are amendable or going to become amendable. And this can affect all this flying that can be outsourced. And yeah, it's kind of messy. So I think in the near term, we see more of the same. Carriers are already being tight on capacity. If oil, for some reason, really starts increasing, there definitely could be more cuts. But in the meantime, I think we're going to keep status quo, because so much of this flying is kind of locked up. So we shall see. I mean, I can always be surprised with what happens. I mean, I was surprised by the American bankruptcy. I was certain that this wasn't going to happen unless the economy went double dip or if oil shot up, and they did it. So... But yeah, regional industry is going to be really, really interesting to watch.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, because, you know, what do you replace these 50-seat RJs with that aren't economical?
Yeah, yeah.
Or even the case of U.S. Airways. I mean, they have a good number of older Dash 8s. You know, what do you replace those with? So.
All right. Thanks for that. Let's see if we can zip through some of these pretty quickly. Got an email from David Abbey. He met aviation photographer Manny Gonzalez. He says, real nice guy to speak with and is quite encyclopedic about planes. And David sent along Manny Gonzalez's website, which is www.thrustimages.com. Manny is quite an accomplished aviation photographer, so if you'd like to kind of browse through some of those images, head on over to thrustimages.com. Well worth it.
So David Abbey actually said something nice about somebody else. This is good. He's usually just picks on me. I mean that he's a cruel guy.
Yeah, well, he likes Manny Gonzalez.
And you're a bitter old man, so there's that.
Actually, Scrooge-like. It's that time of the year.
It is that time of year. Luke wrote in. He says, I've enjoyed watching some YouTube air shows of the new C5M. My question for Max is regarding the old TF-39s. Most know they were the very first high bypass engine, but it was also the only engine to feature a 1.5 stage fan blade section. What are your thoughts on this design? And was it never used on another engine, as the current single fan blade design delivers the same or better results? And is this design the cause of that unique C5 engine whine? I'm a little bit nervous because David's probably going to jump in here with more knowledge than I have. But as far as I know,
David is too kind to do something.
He is, actually. As far as I know, the 1.5 stage fan wasn't used beyond the T-39 engine on the C-5. I located some good photos of this, so if you're kind of curious as what does that mean, a 1.5 stage fan, you can take a look. But basically, imagine a fan as you would normally see it on a high bypass ratio, you know, airline kind of engine, and then a little fan about half the diameter in front of it. So I don't think that was really used anywhere else. That front stage, I mean, actually, that was what was moved back behind the fan and became what we now know as the low pressure compressor, which offered a better solution. But, you know, back in those days when that engine was being developed and others like it, you know, the engineers were trying to figure it out. They really knew a lot less about these things than they do now. And so there were a number of things interesting that were tried. And then, you know, the engineers moved on to other things. So that's my knowledge of that engine. I don't know, David, are you any more knowledgeable?
I know what a C5 looks like.
Okay.
And the reason why I know what a C5 looks like was growing up at every air show,
mm-hmm.
My father's comment to me was, if you ever got lost and separated from me, you go to the really big airplane that opens in the front and opens in the back, and I'll find you.
Okay. Next is from Bruce. Bruce made a couple of comments, but he also says he has a request. He says, I'm sure lots of us were excited to hear about Rob's forthcoming book on the Air France crash. I'd love to have an update. How's it coming along, Rob? Any surprises encountered in your research and writing process?
Actually, I'm very flattered that someone even remembered. Actually, that's part of what I was over in France for last week, in addition to getting this update on safety issues in European aviation. I was meeting with a few folks, contacts, and that's part of, again, part of why I was there was to meet people at the show, I'm sorry, at the conference that were going to be helpful in the book. And so it's actually going pretty well, but I must admit that trying to write a book that has an element of it focused in another country that is not English speaking, that is 6,000 miles away, is no small challenge. Thank goodness at my age, I'm patient, because I think I'm going to need to be. But it is coming along, and I do appreciate the thought.
Bruce also asked, any idea about when it will be published?
I wish I had a number on that. I don't. I think it's going to depend on how things go in the next month or so, based on some of what I learned when I was in Paris last week.
All right. Well, we'll wait patiently. We also got a note from Kaylee from motherboard.tv. Kaylee sent along a link, which I'll put in the show notes. This is kind of a short film, a short documentary about the Swiss inventor, Dr. Bertrand Piccard. And he's the guy that circumnavigated the globe in a balloon nonstop. And this is about the Solar Impulse, the long-range glider, the one with it's got a 63-meter wingspan and 12,000 solar cells. And they're going to try to fly that around the world without fuel in 2014. So this is it's a really interesting video. It's worth watching. It's well-produced. So we'll put that in the show notes.
Okay, is that it?
I got more, but we're running long.
Oh, I think we're... Hey, can we just leave with one quick question I have for Dan?
Okay.
D, Dan, is there anything you can tell listeners about the rumor that United may be the first U.S. Or North American, be U.S. carrier to order A380s?
Oh, there is something that John Leahy from Airbus said. I mean, there's a lot of media speculation about it. I mean, I'll believe it when it's ordered.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Answer.
Well, I
have another shot.
Well, according to what Leahy said, his quote was, "Everyone in Asia Pacific has A380s now. ... If you want to compete in Asia Pacific, at some point in time, United is going to have to get on board with the A380. So, okay. We'll see that. By the way, I have something for Grant.
What's that, Dan?
That whole A320 premium seat thing. There's precedent for it. I don't know the exact dimensions, but I mean, British Airways flies A318s with an all premium class cabin that's with seats that are relatively wide. So there's precedent, bro. Don't freak out.
All right. Well, we're out of time. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest this episode was Greg Morris from Gauntlet Warbirds. Thanks again, Greg, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And you can find Gauntlet Warbirds at gauntletwarbirds.com. We'd also like to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Fisher from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, and also Peter Johnson. You can find him at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online, because I'm sure they're just dying to do that. So, Rob Mark, where do people find out more about you?
Well, actually, luckily these days they don't post those pictures in the post office any longer here in the United States, so nobody can find me there. But in other places, it's at jetwine.com, it's here, it's on Jetwine at Twitter, it's at ComAvia, which is our company site, and heaven knows where else, in Aviation International News Magazine sometimes, and AOPA Pilot, and God knows where else.
Wow, everywhere. Dan Webb, where do people find out more about you?
You can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com, or you can find me on the Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Very good. And David Vanderhoof, where do people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or on my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
And Max, where do they find you?
You can look for me on Google+ and Twitter as Max Flight, and also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com with links to the sites we mentioned in the podcast. And be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. But we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast to your mobile phone. You can send us email. That address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us a voice message. I think Benay Wilson will tell you where that number is.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
As always, opening and closing music by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Finally, one thing you can do for us is go to the iTunes store, search for Airplane Geeks Podcast, and write a brief review. Your feedback helps us, and it helps others find us. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night.
Thanks for listening.
Let's talk about go ahead.
No, that's okay. I'll follow up later. Go ahead, man.
Well, I was going to change the subject a little bit.
Go ahead. You want to talk about how many women you can meet when you hang around these kinds of airplanes?
Oh, I bet. But no, that wasn't it.
Okay.
So, Greg, people can find your website at gauntletwarbirds.com.
Yes.
I thought there was going to be more to it than that.
I did too.
Sorry. Ready for the Australia desk?
I mean, if we were just to conveniently skip it, I mean, I wouldn't say anything.
Oh, David's or Dan's back. I didn't realize Dan was back.
I wrote on the IM window that I'm back.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Actually, okay.
I thought that was a
you. Burp. You can't read, yet they somehow let you teach writing classes, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty cool, isn't it? You know,
well, there's no reading involved with writing.
That's right.
Okay, here's the Australia desk.
Hey, we are live.
The cursing lamp is on.
Or,
I mean, off.
Or we may have been live the whole time. You'll never know. David is far too careful these days to trust me.
Why? You don't think my call recorder went on the moment I got on? I learned my lesson.
Oh, gentlemen. Yeah, he's learned.
Oh, vengeance is a dish best served cold.
He learns quickly, this one. Get on with it. Yes, I am the master.
Only the master of podcasts.
I'll take that. I'll take that. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Three.
Eat that, Max.
David's muty. Can't consume. Doo-da.
Yeah, but just... I can still record. Oh.
By the way, David, let's just review some pronunciation here. Can you say chocolate again?
Hershey's.
There you go. All right, we got a couple.
No, I just want to wait until I have all the packs.
We got a couple of emails.
Now, why would you do that? Oh. It's no fun if you wait until you have all the facts.
By the way, Rob, I think you should work on making an Airplane Geeks collar for Simba.
And that's sometimes called flocking and some other things. Well, this relates to that.
You know, Max, we try not to use that kind of language around here.
This is a PG rate. Okay.
Is that the name of our show, though? The Airplane Geese?
Yep.
Beautiful heaven.